Too many of America's young people learn about war only from Hollywood, politicians, and recruiters. As American teenagers consider enlistment or become voters, they need to hear about the first-hand experiences of men and women who have served, even from those who never saw combat. Since 1982, Vietnam-era veterans in Massachusetts have come together as the Veterans Education Project to speak to high school students. Each year, these veterans talk in nearly 150 classrooms, sharing their stories with thousands of young people.
We'll have another tape that kind of tells the experiences of one veteran of Vietnam. Tape is Beyond Vietnam. It lasts about 54 minutes, and so we're going to show maybe the first half of that towards the end of this hour, and then the second half. We don't have this room again until Thursday, so if you want to see the second half, you'll have to come Thursday. My name is Roland James. I'm from Arizona. I was a member of, or I still am, a member of Alzona Lutheran Church, where Jim Oinous was the pastor. Jim started the sanctuary movement in the Phoenix area, and I've been privileged to work with the organization that he started now for several years, the Valley Religious Task Force on Central America. I'm also the president of the Phoenix chapter of Veterans for Peace, which is a nationwide group of veterans, about 5,000 veterans. We're interested in this issue at a personal level, especially how it affects young people, the issue of peace and justice, militarism. And that's kind of why I led with this tape this morning. I thought we'd get a few young people here, but I think they're probably out doing something more fun than sitting inside today. Interestingly enough, I just received this Lutheran Peace Fellowship newsletter, and in it were a number of interesting articles. I hope you can read it because I kind of reduced it down. But the one article there by Ron Letness, he's an ELCA pastor and is now the director of a camp near Fort Collins, Colorado, perhaps a camp similar to this one. I don't know if any of you are aware of that camp or not, but he became very concerned about the issue of junior ROTC at the high school that his son was attending, and wrote this article. I think he writes very well and kind of summarizes the arguments very well. So that's for your edification. You can take this with you if you like. If you want to keep it, that's fine. If you want to return it to me, that's fine too. I recommended a number of things, or a couple of books. One of them by a group, and specifically by the director of that group, Waldo Bello. The group is Food First. This book is called Dark Victory, and it's available in the bookstore if you'd like a copy. If you don't want to get a copy, I've Xeroxed. I've got a number of Xeroxes, and we'll be discussing this later in the week. But I'd like to kind of read the foreword to the book that kind of puts some of the issues of peace and justice in this time that we're in perspective. The foreword is by Susan George, who's also an author on these subjects. Dark Victory sounds like a 40s film title with brave pilots, courageous sweethearts, and a happy ending. The villains punished, the heroes rewarded, and everything morally neat and tidy as democracy triumphs over fascism. No such luck here. This book, and for that matter, the world of the 90s aren't like that. The Bile and the Villainous are getting their way, overcoming every obstacle, crushing all opposition in their path. But wait, they too may get their comeuppance in the next millennium. Those who appear supremely confident today are in fact running scared. They have overstretched their reach and are in inexorable decline. They have led us into a kind of late, very late Roman Empire on a global scale, and the only sure thing is that at the end of this particular movie, the set will be littered with bodies. Waldo Bello and his colleagues Shay Cunningham and Bill Rao explained here exactly what happened in the 1980s. It happened so fast you could well have missed it if you were looking the other way. Very few scholars have, up to now, attempted to show how all the pieces fit together. Reaganism and Thatcherism were only the tip of this iceberg of something called rollback, which was a worldwide phenomenon. This strategy, the child of the new conservative establishment and of transnational, mostly U.S. capital, was to the South what the policy of containment was to the East. Rollback meant an end to third world pretensions. There was to be no more talk of a new international economic order, binding codes of conduct for foreign investors, mandatory transfers of technology, or managed commodity prices. The South was to return to that quiescent state from which it should never have been allowed to emerge. The unruly would be disciplined and the rebellious cowed. Bello et al. Build their case with relentless scholarship. The familiar cycle of debt, balance of payments crises, and adjustment under the tutelage of the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund is crisply laid out, its consequences as well. Even those who think they know the structural adjustment scenario inside out will be grateful to Bello for taking on the toughest cases for examinations. Countries like Mexico, Chile, Costa Rica, Ghana, often cited by the bank and the fund as star pupils. The stars are decidedly tarnished when Bello has finished with them. The debt cum adjustment crisis is shown for what it is, a protracted war against the poor, which is reminiscent of a book that maybe some of you are familiar with by a ELCA pastor, Jack Nelson Pallmeyer, War Against the Poor, Low Intensity Conflict in Christian Faith, that came out 3 or 4 years ago. Less well known is the parallel war against that more limited part of the South, which is not head over heels in debt and is therefore immune to discipline via structural adjustment. Competition from the newly industrialized countries, the famous dragons or tigers, is unwelcome, though their increasingly opulent markets are coveted. Dragons are made to be slain and tigers to be hunted. Trade regulations and penalties will do as well as lances and rifles. The war against the South is accompanied by another war on the home front, this time against the workforce inside the United States. Here is quintessential Reaganism on its own ground, bringing home the iron law of economics to the millions. The point of capitalism is not to provide decent jobs at decent wages, but to make as large a profit as possible. End of story. One could wish that Bello had made more of the complicity of Southern elites who on the whole lie back and enjoy rollback because they too profit hugely from it. A North versus South empire versus, a North versus South empire versus barbarian scenario, yes, but other serious players But another serious player is the trend national elite to match trends national capital, sitting pretty at the top with everyone else underneath. The world is sphere, north, south, is also world is pyramid, and those at the apex are not all white. In these ongoing wars, nearly everyone loses, and the slim hope for change lies in the fact that they may decide that they will not lose quietly. A dubious battle indeed that leads to such victory, be it dark or hollow. The other book that I recommended was The Year 501, The Conquest Continues. Actually, a book that maybe some of you are familiar with that kind of should be read maybe even before that is The People's History of the United States by Howard Zinn, which essentially is a history of the United States from the point of view of the oppressed, from the point of view of the losers. It's one of my favorite books, and I don't know if it's in the library here or not. I didn't see it, but it's well worth reading. Zinn, who's a professor at MIT, says about Chomsky's book, Year 501 is another awesome achievement by Noam Chomsky. For those of you that aren't aware of Chomsky, he's some consider him the leading intellectual in the United States. He won a Nobel Prize in linguistics. He writes prolifically, about a book a year. He was the subject of a very good documentary, Manufacturing Consent, about a year ago. A 2.5-hour documentary that received quite a bit of praise. I brought some videos along, but I didn't bring that one. But Zinn says about Chomsky's book, Year 501, is another awesome achievement by Noam Chomsky. It is a devastating array of information about the U.S. role in the world, placed in the long historical perspective of the 500 years that followed the voyages of Columbus. The result is a wonderful single-volume education in history and world politics. And it's essentially more contemporary, of course, than Zinn's book. To tell you a little bit about what we're going to do this week, as I said, we'll watch the first half of Beyond Vietnam in a few minutes. I'd like to, instead of talking about church and nonviolence or church and violence on Thursday, talk about it the next time this group meets, which will be Wednesday. Using the ELCA study on peace, God's gifts, our task, and also the first draft of the proposed social statement. I wrote a response that there are copies of, and you can take, if you like, copies of these with you and read them over, or there are copies, I believe, in the library and resource centers. If you'd like to kind of prepare a little bit for Wednesday, you don't have to do that. You can take a copy of a response that I wrote to the study. There's also a interesting article Dietrich Bonhoeffer, Cry Faithfulness, that appeared in The Other Side magazine a couple of years ago. You can take copies of that. And there's an article here by Gary Coles, who's an MD, who I guess has been in Holland a couple of times. I noticed articles by him, who has written a very interesting article, The Church and Nonviolence. I don't mean to overlap what Mark Rich is going to be doing this week, or Steve Zunas.
Yeah.
I probably won't be discussing the Middle East specifically, or Jesus and nonviolence and the New Testament basis for pacifism, as opposed to, there's a oral confusion with that word, but maybe I'll get into that a little bit later in the week. But hopefully there'll be some cross-pollinization, and if you have a thought,
the bottom line of my t-shirt says share it, so anytime,
if that seems convenient,
hopefully we'll have more discussion the next four sessions. Today we have these two videos, and hopefully we'll have a little time for discussion after showing the first half of Beyond Vietnam.
Can I ask a quick question?
Yes.
First video. These vets came into the schools to talk?
In Massachusetts, they've been able to do that.
How could they do that?
They've done some in Seattle, too, I think.
I think in some areas, veterans have been allowed to do that. In Arizona, it's been very difficult for us to get into the schools. Arnold Schwarzenegger, who makes very violent movies, is, you know, leading calisthenics with the governor in our schools. But for a non-violent activist to get into the schools, that's too controversial. So it's difficult. But well, in some areas, they have been able to.
Does the school institutionally invite them in, or does a particular teacher invite them in
I think it's a specific teacher, usually. It has to be someone that's kind of committed and who believes that there should be a balance to the recruiting efforts of the military in our schools. But the schools should not just allow the recruiters kind of free run of the schools. We have shown this video, Beyond Vietnam, in a couple of schools, and a few churches have used it. I just saw this for the first time at the National Veterans for Peace Conference last August. It's won a number of awards. I think it's the best thing that's been done on Vietnam, including the Academy Award-winning movie Platoon. It has a long song at the beginning that maybe some of you would just assume we kind of fast-forward through. It's by Billy Joel. But if you want to do that, we can do that. But I'll put that in and...
Combat engineers from September 1967 until May of 1969. Steve presently serves on the National Board of Directors of Vietnam Veterans of America, where he chairs a special committee on post-traumatic stress disorders. He is also a member of the National Advisory Committee for Veterans for Peace Incorporated. In these capacities, Steve has traveled all over the United States, to Central America, England, and Russia during the past 5 years. In these countries, he has met with combatants from World War I, World War II, Korea, Vietnam, Afghanistan, Algeria, the Falklands, Middle East, Northern Ireland, and the Central American Wars. He has also met extensively with those mental health professionals who try to help many of the men and women who were psychologically and emotionally scarred by these conflicts. The following program is based on a talk that evolved from all these experiences and was given in hundreds of high schools and colleges throughout the state of Maine during the past 5 years. Steve is currently Director of Veterans Employment and Training Services Incorporated in Portland, Maine.
Vietnam, a lot of people in my school, I guess, don't really know exactly what happened, except that all these protesters are saying, you know, we shouldn't do this, we shouldn't be here, you know, the veterans coming home, and, you know, why is this happening? I think that's pretty much all that people in my school know. They don't really know exactly like how the veterans feel themselves.
Things are so messed up now, it's a real, I don't see how, I mean, you know, definitely there is a way to stop war, you know. I mean, the big thing is, you know, each and every day, you know, adventures come up, you know, there's either big wants to get out and test it for their own, you know, and then conflicts arise. So I don't know how peace is ever going to come, you know. I mean, you know, it will come one day, hopefully.
It's one thing to learn about something like a war, such as Vietnam, through books, but it's experience to have someone who actually was there and knows the feelings of the people that were involved.
This country will always, you know, its value will always be kind of violence, and that we won't learn by our experiences, and then definitely have to discuss, you know, now we're back, supposedly, and that's just, you know, that's not going to help it out, and so we'll just be centered more on violence, and, you know, that's really too bad. I thought we had some progress.
Feeling of leaving, abandoning the people that you had been with. And so everyone had kind of a sense of survivor guilt that they left people behind and when they went home. Another factor, and perhaps the biggest factor, and the one that we heard a lot about even with the Gulf War, and we saw little pieces of it, was the controversy. What I mean by we saw pieces of it was we had in the very beginning, there were some people who were starting to protest about our involvement in there, and you'd see them on CNN, and then you saw the protesters on the other side who were for what was going on in the Gulf. And what that did was bring a lot back for a lot of Vietnam veterans, because for many years during the Vietnam War, the controversy was a large factor. It was a Gallup poll. Gallup poll was done in 1975. They asked, that was right after the fall of Saigon. They asked 1,200 Vietnam veterans, they said, is the war right or was the war wrong? And what they got was a 49% to 51% split. Now, what's important to recognize about this is that these feelings, it's like the Vietnam veteran carries the politics of the war in their wounds. And these feelings run very, very deep when I say, were you for the war or against it? For instance, I have a friend named John. John was in the Marine Corps in Vietnam. He was wounded twice, the second time severely. Both times that he was wounded, his driver was killed. He was a lieutenant. And John believes that these men died for nothing. He feels that he was lied to and used and betrayed by this country. He's real angry at the left-wing politicians, the people that we call the doves, the people that were against the war. He hates Jane Fonda with a passion. Jane Fonda came to symbolize a certain part of the peace movement, was very vocal during that time period. She even took a trip to Hanoi. John thinks we were doing the right thing. He thinks we were fighting communism. He'd go back and he would do it again. And see, I came to believe, I spent 2 years in Vietnam, and I too lost friends. I came to believe that our policy in Vietnam was wrong, that we never should have been over there. I'm not saying that the soldier was wrong. I'm saying that the government policy was wrong. Soldiers just do what they're told. That's what they're trained to do. So I too have, as I say, lost friends. I too came home and felt lied to and used and betrayed. In fact, some of these people died for nothing, and I was angry, just like John was. But see, my targets were different. I was angry at some of the right-wing politicians and the hawks and the people who were beating the war drum and some of the large companies that I felt made money off of it. Politicians who were trying to further their careers by beating the war drum, people who had never been to war and didn't know what the horror of it was. My point about this is that inside, in our guts, at a feeling level, John and I feel exactly the same way. We both feel lied to, unused, and betrayed. We also both are trying to find the truth. We both want justice. That was something we were taught growing up in this country that we believe in. But we have different ways of defining what that is. We have different ways of conceptualizing how to bring justice about, how to do the right thing, what is fair and true about what happened with Vietnam.
It's gotta be left or right. It's gotta be left or right. It's gotta be left or right.
I'm 43 years old. That makes me the average age of the Vietnam veteran. I grew up getting some very specific messages about the nature of the world and the United States and our place in the world. You know, your education clearly is more than what happens in a classroom or what goes on in school. I mean, it's what happens Friday and Saturday night. It's what goes on with your friends. It's what happens with your parents. It's everything that we're subjected to in our lives. That's our education. And we certainly get our education, I did, out of the television set, but out of the movies. And the very first television set set we ever had was in black and white. And back in those days, they had these cowboy and western shows on. And there were good guys and bad guys. They even wore white hats and black hats, and they rode white horses and dark horses, so you could tell what the good guys and bad guys were. Later on, we had color television, and then there was movies like John Wayne and the Sands of Iwo Jima, which was a famous World War II battle. And there were people like Audie Murphy, who was a real World War II hero, who went on to make movies. But the message in these new color movies was still in black and white. And the message was, one of them, was that there were good guys and bad guys in the world. And that the bad guys were commies and dinks and gooks and Japs and genetically predetermined thugs. And Indians were bad guys in those days. You know, if the Indians won a battle, it was a massacre. But if the cavalry won a battle, then it was a victory. And the other message was that the good guys in the world were lo and behold and were Americans. You know, that we were somehow better than all other people. You know, that we were brighter and smarter and stronger and braver. And that we had a special place in the world. Now the message that I got along with that, the message that was added to that, was that in order to be a man in America, I had to be more than just against bad guys. In order to be a man in America, I had to kill bad guys. And the more bad guys I kill, the more the man I want. Now, you see, I didn't know a thing about the Korean War. They always seemed to close that part of the textbook before we got to it, you know, there wasn't time to study that. But I did know that any good top-down American pilot could shoot down 20 of them gooks before breakfast. You know, I got that message. As time went on in the early 60s, when I was growing into my teens, John F. Kennedy was elected president of the United States. And I was getting the same kind of message then, but it was a little more sophisticated. John F. Kennedy was saying things like he could see the campfires of the enemy burning. And he was saying, ask not what your country can do for you, but rather what you can do for your country. And he was talking about how Americans had a special place in the world. And I can remember there was a Green Beret by the name of Barry Sadler who came back from Vietnam. He was on national television. And he was singing a song called The Ballad of the Green Beret that he had written in Vietnam. And the lyrics went something like, silver wings upon their chests, these are men, America's best. 100 men will test the day, but only 3 win the Green Beret. And I remember watching him on the show. It was like, it'd be like watching him on MTV today. Like, I got these chills on my back, you know, kind of like I'm sure some people did when they saw Whitney Houston sing the Star Spangled Banner at the Super Bowl. You know, it was just all this pride. I thought to myself, that's what a man is, you know, that's what a hero is. That age between 12 and 20 is, according to the foremost developmental psychologists, that's when our task in life is identity versus role confusion, which is another way of saying that's when we're trying to decide, who am I? Where do I fit in? You know, what do I believe in? What are my values? What am I about? How do I win the love and the respect of my peers and the people around me? What am I going to be when I grow up? You know, that kind of thing. And I wanted to be a man. And I had a father that was also sending me messages about manhood that fit in with what I've been getting from the movies and things. He was a police lieutenant. As near as I can tell, he single-handedly won the Second World War. And he was telling me what I should do is go to Vietnam and win some medals and be a man. So I volunteered to join the Army. And then I volunteered for Vietnam. And when I got to Vietnam, I volunteered again for a high-risk job. I was a combat engineer. And I volunteered for a high-risk job, and we had a price on our hands. What I was a Rome plow operator. Now, a Rome plow is a special kind of a bulldozer to cut jungle with. And what I would do, part of it, we might be building a special forces camp. So we'd go out into the jungle, and I'd be one of the first ones in, so I could clear the jungle away so that they could come in and start work on this camp. And we're a very easy target because you can't tiptoe through the jungle with 25-ton bulldozer. They know where you are. And they knew where we were going to be every day. So they could put a grenade in one tree and run a wire to a grenade in another tree, or they could set mines for us. So in one four-month period, I lost three assistant operators. One was blown apart by a rocket-propelled grenade launcher, one was blown apart by an anti-tank mine, and one was captured. And I got to find out that the bottom line in the wall was real ugly, and that John Wayne and Rambo were full of beans, with men barricading and screaming and calling and racing my experience. And all that talk about democracy and communism and idealism, all that went right out the window. You know, when you look into death at that age, and the finality of it, and the horror of it, all you want to do is survive, all you want to do is get through it, to survive that moment. You know, and to cut off your feelings, do what you have to do. Now later on, I was in relatively more secure areas in Vietnam. Although no place, as I say, was absolutely secure over there. I might be doing something like clearing away bamboo because we were getting sniper fire alongside the road, so I'd have to push the bamboo back from the side of the highway. I might be knocking over rubber trees, or I might be pushing over part of the village, and I'd have to look into the eyes of the people who destroyed everything they own. And when we were in these places, sometimes the Vietnamese and the Cambodians would come out during the day, and they'd come out in their Hondas, and they'd come out on their bicycles, and they'd sell us things. They'd sell us Coca-Cola, and they'd sell us sandwiches, and they'd sell us themselves. There was a lot of prostitution in Vietnam. So that was another message I got about men, that I was supposed to use a lot of women, and I was supposed to drink a lot of booze. On my pursuit of manhood, I found out, lo and behold, these people were not slimy goats, and they didn't have one eye in the center of their forehead, long teeth hanging out of their hand. I found out they were real live human beings, and they laughed, and they cried, and they had feelings, and they were no different than myself, and no different than other Americans. And it wasn't like these two things that I learned there. One was that the bottom line was that it's madness. And it's not glory at all. And the other being that the lie about us and them, the lie that human beings are different from one another. It wasn't like I just woke up one day and said, well, these things were true yesterday and now these things are true today. It was more like I had the ground pulled right out from under me, that rocked the very foundations of all I had been taught. So when I came back, when I got home, I went through a litany of drug addictions and alcohol addictions and hospitalization. I went through 16 or 20 different jobs. Slashed my wrists, I overdosed on Sentinel, I overdosed on Quaaludes, had over 200 stitches in my body from bar fights and street fights. And I thought that there was something wrong in me, that I had failed the manhood test. And somehow I had failed the test of war. And what I discovered, when I got started to turn my life around, and I went back to school, and I got a degree in psychology, and then a master's in rehabilitation counseling. And I discovered that I was not the long ranger. That I was the only one that went through these kinds of things in Vietnam, that had these kinds of experiences when I got home. In fact, I found out that in 1978 there was a study done called the Forgotten Warrior Project, where they estimated that from a half to three quarters of a million Vietnam veterans had significant to severe readjustment problems. The New England Journal of Medicine did a study on suicides of Vietnam veterans, and one of the chief researchers in that study said that he felt that the number of suicides could be as high as the number that were killed in Vietnam. These are guys that killed themselves when they came home.